Flaxo Radio,
amplificando ideas.
Bien, estamos nuevamente entonces con esa transmisión de las conferencias magistrales en este tercer Congreso Latinoamericano y Caribeño de Ciencias Sociales que se desarrolla en nuestra sede aquí en Quito, Flaxo, Ecuador. Más de 300 espacios de discusión que se están desarrollando ya en esta primera jornada con el acto inaugural que se desarrolló ayer con la conferencia magistral de Aníbal Quijano. 18 ejes temáticos que atraviesan este congreso y 1.200 investigadores y académicos de todo el mundo que están presentes en esta cita académica. Bueno, entonces tenemos ya la señal desde el auditorio de Flaxo Ecuador. El profesor Ernesto Vivares está haciendo la presentación de TV Poll, quien realizará la segunda conferencia magistral. Así es que de inmediato tomamos la señal. Y siga usted escuchando Flaxo Radio, www.flaxoradio.es.
TV tiene 16 libros publicados en el tema, lo cual no es de menor importancia, lo que implica que ha dedicado gran parte de su vida a la investigación de cómo están transitando y dándose todos estos temas en la geopolítica, la seguridad y la defensa a nivel internacional. Más allá de los resultados de su investigación, que uno lo puede encontrar en las páginas de internet donde aparecen cerca de 50, 60 artículos indexados, y quienes estamos en nuestro ambiente sabemos lo que significa producir un artículo indexado, TV tiene el privilegio y el honor, y es un honor para nosotros tenerlo acá por una razón muy importante. Él es el segundo presidente del Sur Global de la International Studies Association. El primero fue Amitav Acharya, que seguramente muchos conocen su trabajo, y ahora el segundo es TV. Y en este sentido, el profesor Paul, aparte de su prolífera producción académica, es una persona muy comprometida, y por eso nos está visitando para promover este tema de integración en el sur global, el desarrollo de temas académicos y todo, y yo me voy a tomar la libertad de decirles que cualquier duda que tengan después o que quieran conversar en materia institucional, no duden en acercarse. Profesor Paul es sumamente cálido en ese sentido y abierto al diálogo. Y en este sentido, yo creo que es una oportunidad para todos tenerlo. Y es precisamente parte de la riqueza de este tipo de eventos. No solamente presentar a veces papeles o discutirlo, lo cual es muy importante como parte de nuestra investigación, sino ver cómo construimos comunidades epistémicas en el Global Sur, en nuestros temas, cómo promovemos colegas y cómo salimos adelante en esto que tiene que ver con el desafío tecnológico de desarrollo. Yo no voy a agregar más nada, yo creo que los hechos hablan por sí mismos y ahora voy a dejar la palabra al profesor TV Poll para que desarrolle su tema. Profesor.
Good afternoon, everybody. It's a real pleasure for me and my wife sitting here, Rachel, to visit your beautiful country. We just came back from Galapagos, and not only we met some wonderful wild animals, but the people that we were very impressed with from different provinces, they were also part of our tour group. And we were just saying how warm and friendly a society you have. Let me thank you, Ernesto, for inviting me. Obviously, your secretary did a lot of work, and this is my first trip to this country, but I have been to other Latin American countries, but I really like to know a little bit more about your contributions and your intellectual achievements. I want to take 2 minutes to discuss, tell you what International Studies Association, which I'm going to preside over starting March, planning with respect to Global South. One of my primary motives of getting to that position was to do something about the total lack of participation by the Global South in ISA, although 50% of ISA's membership is coming from the rest of the world, non-North America, mostly Europe, advanced countries. Barring Brazil and Mexico, as well as Turkey, there are not too many Global South countries participate in ISA activities, partly because of financial constraints, and a perception that it is a North American thing, but it is changing dramatically. And I would really encourage you, your students, to try to come to our conferences. There's a deadline, you go to the webpage, apply in time. It's all automatic, the process. And obviously there is selection process. They will first time may not get in, but one has to keep trying. There are also regional meetings, association meetings, in conjunction with other. All the information is on the ISA webpage. And it's really a good exposure for your students. And they do give some financial support, not a whole lot, but somewhat enough for at least living costs and things like that. We are trying our best to increase that amount, which obviously is finding some resistance, but that is part of the challenge. So graduate students sometimes get more attention. Secondly, we are starting an initiative called a Presidential Task Force on Global South, which I'm hoping to discuss with your colleagues. We need as much input as we can on different countries and their difficulties, structural and other constraints, what we can do to promote IR and international studies broadly defined in the rest of the world, and also to learn from your experience, because you have a lot to offer. I come from a country called India originally, but so I know a lot about their constraints. It'll be really great to get together and then discuss what we can do to promote IR, a very important discipline. And a third thing, I won't take much time on it, is essentially we are proposing the creation of regional sections for ISA, which would mean a Latin America section, Africa section, East Asia section, etc. Right now, there is nothing much except a Global South Caucus. That way, you can organize with your institution, co-organize some of these conferences, attracting a lot more people. The only challenge is it has to be approved through different channels, and hopefully by this March, we will have the approval. And then you need 250 members to initiate it with all kinds of little requirements. Finally, we are really trying to globalize as much as we can. And opportunities like this don't come. And I put my conference theme for 2017 conference as Change in World Politics, which you also encourage you to submit panels and proposals. That much for ISA, because it is a lot of story there in such a short period of time, I can tell you. This is a book I just edited, coming out of Cambridge University Press in February. The book is titled Accommodating Rising Powers, Past, Present, and Future. It will be available at some of these conferences. And it was an effort to understand whether peaceful change is possible with respect to the adjustment of power that is going on in the world today. And what we have witnessed in the last year or two is a dramatic upsurge in violence in East China, South China Sea, particularly in Russia with respect to its near abroad, and then China pushing hard to increase its sphere of influence and territorial claims. We just witnessed the 100th anniversary of World War I. And the more you read about that war, and even World War II, you realize how stupid it was to fight that war. It was a bunch of men sitting in councils of Vienna and Berlin and places like that with absolutely no sense of what it is going to cause, the suffering, the enormous tragedy. And when I did this book, I was trying to read, did anybody think of alternatives on this subject? There's one E.H. Carr, basically, who wrote about peaceful change. He's a realist, by the way. He was a realist, but not many. Because Europeans were ready for war, fight. They were not trained to engage in thinking about how to adjust and accommodate. But I must tell you that I don't want to blame the Europeans entirely, because a generation, actually 100 years before, in Vienna, 1815, some Europeans met, of course, colonial world, and decided to integrate a defeated France, Napoleon's brutal wars, and change the whole dynamics. So statecraft played a big role in that transition. But that did not last long. The same folks end up in this immense violence that really engulfed the world. So today we are in a situation of power transition. Whatever we say, the material changes that we are witnessing today, of course, the last few days, the stock market plunging and Shanghai in trouble. And despite all that, the fact that the material world is changing, Americans cannot retain the hegemony for too long. They're trying their best. there will be others as their economies rise. And then, of course, even if countries don't have the power, as Russia, for instance, they can challenge hegemony through symmetric means. And especially in the era of IT and using the cyberspace as their weapon. And so even if rising powers don't engage in war, they can create a lot of turmoil, a lot of tension, a lot of difficulties for the international order, as the Russians are already doing and the Americans and the Europeans are responding to that. And we know that the global governance issue is a very important issue. And this dissonance can occur not only in outward in media space, but at institutions. And that is why you don't have trade liberalization or climate change areas. And for several years, we are having these debates and very difficult to get agreements. And that itself is a challenge to establish order in the international system. Now, this volume is guided by a central concern for major power accommodation, war prevention. Because even though we may think that we are out of it because we have nuclear weapons, we don't need to worry about it, great power conflicts, great power rivalries will suck you all into it. You may recall the Cold War and how Latin America, South America, Central America became part of it. There's nothing much you can do because you become part of this global conflict. We want to avoid that next conflict involving whether it is the United States or the rising powers. And how do you do that? And that is the big challenge, this volume that we are putting together. So what we did was we have a set of chapters, papers that look at the theoretical arguments, mostly using the typical IR, realism, liberalism, constructivism, and then look at some cases of failed accommodations and successful accommodation. You would be surprised, the successful accommodations are very, very few. There's only one, the big one, which is the United Kingdom or Great Britain accommodating the United States at the end of the 19th century. And that too, the United States pushed hard to its way and British had no choice but to leave. Then there is a partial accommodation of China in 1972. And Nixon visited and creating that. But that is now unraveling slowly as Chinese ambitions are changing too. So this is a big problem in world politics, the rise and decline of great powers. Of course, Paul Kennedy has a very interesting book on it, but it has always been, or almost always been, accompanied by violence or big conflict. And that is what the big puzzle, how to avoid that. So accommodation is not necessarily easy. Easy because it involves power, status, material adjustment, global governance involvement, acceptance by others. Because as you know, when somebody is top dog, that person or country gets a lot of acceptance. It becomes hegemonic and very hard to replace a hegemony until you have something better coming. The Chinese can talk about replacing it, but what will they replace it with? That is another question that often comes to mind. I kind of categorize different kind of accommodation, full accommodation at the global level, giving the rising power considerable leadership role, conduct of international politics, etc. And that the example is obviously UK and United States. There is partial or limited accommodation that is mostly institutional. And here I include the idea of China's 1972 accommodation. Non-accommodation at the global level is when a rising power with most of the material parameters, a great power status, has been largely ignored in the conduct of international governance. It is not recognized. Defeated Germany after World War I falls into this category, and Japan during the interwar period, another example. Symbolic accommodation is essentially giving some measure of symbolic adjustment. The United States accommodated symbolically India by giving the nuclear deal and giving the verbal idea that you can be a member of the Security Council, etc. Region-specific accommodation, and here I think the rising powers, the BRICS, are getting some of that, Brazil in particular, South Africa to some extent. Then you start looking at these, the history of accommodations, it looks like, as I said, very, very rare and very, very few. That's probably why we need to go to some of the foundational theories. And I was surprised to notice IR as a discipline has failed in this area. I can't see much talking about this subject. For instance, the dominant realist discourse, it's all about war. It's Gilpin, it's Mearsheimer. You know, Gilpin is actually quite interesting. He talks about peaceful change a little bit. But the dominant discourse is structure that matters, balance of power that matters. And then you have all these power transition theories. Again, dominant school of that is war as the mechanism for change. And then you, well, part of it is they have a lot of history to show. I mean, we cannot say that there is no history of it. So they will pick that history. And that's why E.H. Carr is so interesting. I encourage everyone to go back and read, if you're interested in what I'm talking, his 20 years crisis. I quote, "The problem of peaceful change in national politics is how to effect necessary and desirable changes without revolution. And in international politics, how to effect such changes without war." Then he was giving the exhortation to Great Britain. "The defense of the status quo is not a policy which can be lastingly successful. It will end in war, as surely as rigid conservatism will end in revolution. Resistance to aggression, however necessary as a momentary device of national policy, is no solution. For readiness to fight to prevent change is just as unmoral," he uses the word unmoral, he's a realist, remember, "as readiness to fight to enforce it. To establish methods of peaceful change is therefore the fundamental problem of international morality and of international politics." I mean, this is coming from this hardcore classical realist. I mean, his prudence is one of his, I mean, he's a lot more than a realist, so I have to be careful. In recent years, there are some books. Charles Kupchan has a book. Then there are a few others like Stephen Rock, "The Conditions That Lead to Rapprochement," etc. There's literature on enduring rivalries, how they end, etc. And so the challenge is how we can draw ideas from the literature. And what is most surprising is the whole focus of especially structural realism is bipolarity is better, multipolarity is bad, balance of power is very important. But I'm actually working on a book on a soft balancing in world politics, using historical cases, starting with the concept of Europe, League of Nations, etc., which are building upon my article in International Security on this subject, essentially arguing that institutions are also arenas for great power politics. And here, the problem is, realists don't recognize institutions, because institutions are epiphenomena of power, as we know. So the strategies are essentially deterrence, containment, balance of power. Maintain status quo, stability. Stability is very important. Without it, the world will be in a bad place. But the problem is, that is the approach that has produced quite a few wars. To protect balance of power, you have to fight. And to protect deterrence, you have to fight. And that generated so much violence. And so then, of course, nuclear weapons, today's world. But what is interesting is the designing around of nuclear weapons. I come from South Asia, work a lot on India-Pakistan rivalry. The Pakistanis are now designing around using the asymmetric forces to fight their war, because they know that the Indians can't retaliate, so they're using terrorist groups or whatever groups to get Kashmir out of India. And the Indians are coming up with all kinds of counter activities. Liberalism actually is perhaps the most interesting for peaceful change, because they do talk about change. You know, liberalism has got a lot of strands, and there are commercial liberalism, there are democratic liberalism. So their argument is that if you get three things, that's all the Kantian tripod, you need democracy, countries are democratic, then they can adjust. You need interdependence, economic interdependence, then you need institutions. If the three are there, then countries will make peaceful change possible. But the problem is, what if the rising power is not democratic? This is where the liberals have no answer how to deal with China. If you can't understand that problem, the liberals will say, maybe we need to fight a war to change China. Until China changes, it's not going to change. We can try our best to use institutions, to use trade, etc. Constructivists have a lot to offer, but I submit that they haven't really gone beyond too much on the subject of peaceful change. Of course, the security community literature is very interesting, and I cite a lot of that. And I think it is also important to look at ideas, ideational change. The big problem is, how do you create that intersubjectivity with the Chinese, with the Russians, with the Indians, and where the, what are the concrete ideas for a policymaker to draw upon? If they can, I think this will be a great opportunity. I also think that constructivism's Achilles heel is that it is all about Western norms. I mean, I'm sure work is coming out of your region, which we don't get to read, so sorry to say that. Then, of course, Amitabh Acharya and people like that do Southeast Asian work. But the problem is, the Western ideas and also good norms, good cases are picked. We really need to look at why bad norms propagate, as we see in the Middle East today, or what are the contributions that non-Western countries, including South American world, have produced to understand change and ideas. I think it's a long way to go. I think there's great opportunity. So I do think that it will be helpful to focus on beyond these picking cases that fits into one's perspective kind of thing. We all do that, but I think it is a challenge in constructivism. I do like the eclectic approach. That's why I think it's useful to sort of identify the areas where different perspectives contribute. People like John Mueller, John Vasquez have written about it. Mueller's famous book, Obsolescence of War, is an interesting one. So within the next few minutes I have, what are the grand strategies or strategies of peaceful change? I submit that, yes, structural conditions will make it very hard for a rising and established power to accommodate. But we need to try. We need to look at statecraft. We need to look at strategies. What kind of strategies can produce peaceful outcome? Conversely, what kind of strategies will produce revisionist states bent on military violence for change? And I think what I'm in this project also try to show that the rising power has a responsibility. The rising power cannot just say, oh, I'll accept me, you know. The rising power has to seek incremental change, as the Chinese for two decades did. Peaceful rise, peaceful development. Deng Xiaoping. But today, Deng is dead. It's basically the geopolitical Sun Tzu Clausewitzian world is emerging. I pity the Chinese. If they continue this path, they're going to end up in conflict. They need to revisit their successful integration in the international order. First country, rising power, that managed to acquire almost 30-40% of the global GDP without a war. And if they don't do that, it's going to hurt them, similar to, of course, us too. So I think the important thing is that how much you can accommodate, how much you will synchronize the strategies. The strategy of accommodation essentially is one of gradual one. You cannot expect, I'm experiencing a bit that in ISA, as I said, you cannot expect sudden change. I keep telling my Global South, a few of us are in the meetings, Rome was not built in one day. It takes time, you know. So we need to keep trying. There's no way you can just say, get everything that we want. What are the areas where accommodation is possible, should be thought about? Ideological and normative accommodation. When established powers and rising powers accept the core ideological normative framework of international order as legitimate. Legitimacy is very crucial. That's where when the Chinese try to build these little islets, there's a problem of legitimacy. Who will recognize that? Of course, they can, with the muscle power, sit there. Or the Americans enter into Iraq and Afghanistan, whatever, who is recognized? Where is the legitimacy? So we need to think about legitimacy, and that is very important. And so territorial accommodation, this is where another big challenge today. Today it's not direct territorial conquest. It is essentially spheres of influence. I think the Russians and the Chinese have probably legitimate grievances, the Russians in particular. But the response of using power, military power, to change regional status quo, put these countries under their thumb, is not going to work. So they need more institutional and other approaches to create that kind of order. Economic accommodation. Peaceful power transition can occur because economic interdependence, multifaceted economic interdependence, will make it very hard for a challenger or an established state to engage in conflict. And that is already happening. Whatever the bad thing about globalization, I'm not a fan of many of its. One thing is the rising powers like China, India, and Brazil up to some years ago managed to gain a lot as countries in a very short period of time. Not as people, okay. The average Indian or average Chinese probably benefiting, but it's very hard to say how effectively. But the point is that in previous historical eras, that was a big complaint of the Germans and the Japanese and the Italians. We need the Lebensraum. We need the territory to spread our people to kind of make it possible to survive. So survival depends on conquest. Today that is not an issue, but at least because of territorial integrity norm, etc. Institutional accommodation. This, I think, is very important for the Global South. And of course, the Global South rising powers. They need to feel they have some sense of belonging, some sense in the administration of things, the governance of things. We have made some progress in the last 20 years, but it has been very much up and down because UN is not reforming. Then, of course, the other countries are forming their own little subgroups. So it is critical to look at then what the problems will crop up in this process. The slow process, I said, the biggest challenge is the rise of nationalism in rising powers. Nationalism and perceived sense of grievance. Because when you get more material strength, you're not getting the status. By the way, I did a book on that too, if you look into that. And it generates a lot of bad feeling among people. It's an easy one to provoke nationalism. So Chinese can be told, you deserve more, but look, they're not giving it to you. You need to fight. And then the ruling elite who are not secure can use this as an opportunity to expand, externalize. I just worry that if the economic conditions worsen in China, you will see some externalization. The only way the Communist Party can stay probably maybe more externalization. So this is a big challenge, how to contain this nationalism, the danger of national, and demagogues, people who can speak and influence the public to think in a violent way, young people in particular. I was in China in 2012 when the Japanese anti-protest was going on. Some cities I visited, I watched, I must say that they are capable of, if you provoke them, doing things that you think they were not. But luckily that subsided, but we don't know the next one coming. So then we have case studies, as I mentioned, but there are also studies on, we picked only four countries, given that the volume is already 15 chapters. We look at the failure with respect to Japan, Germany, then success, US, with, and then China. And then the emerging four BRIC countries, China, India, Brazil, and Russia, trying to show that where they are, what are their problems, will they be challengers, whether they can be accommodated. And the kind of conclusion is that, unfortunately, Russia, we lost a lot of opportunity. The Russians should have been integrated much better than what the West did. And here, I think John Mearsheimer may have a point. Essentially, the West thought they won the Cold War. They thought NATO and EU expansion won't hurt the Russians. That was a big mistake not to bring them along. I'm not justifying the brute force that Mr. Putin is engaging in. But the point is that the Russians have a long historical memory, which is not very pleasant. if you read the Napoleonic invasion to Hitler, to the Western intervention after the revolution. And the Russians are not integrated beyond the trade. So the trade, their students don't come to Western universities as much as Chinese do or Indians do. But they have a lot of problems in understanding, appreciating. Status matters a lot to them. And that status is great power status. The moment you fiddle around their periphery, encouraging Ukrainians, I mean, you know, we all know that Ukraine needs sovereignty and all that. Asking them either join the EU or the Russian built institution, that's a mistake. That the Russians feel that you are trying to create. EU comes first and then NATO comes next, containing them again. So strategic thinking, this is where the liberals of Europe, the liberals of America have failed. There is a thinking that we won, the liberals won, end of history kind of argument. Therefore, we don't need to worry about it. But we need to think about what the other side is feeling or fearing. Let me sort of conclude in another 5 minutes by showing that, in fact, the case studies show that a lot of blunders were made by established powers. And look where we are today. Some 75 million dead, entire European history transformed, world history transformed. Of course, it produced decolonization maybe later on. But the point is that whether we could have thought about peaceful change. And where are the winners of that war today? Great Britain won the war. Unfortunately, the great you have to keep adding because it is no longer that great. Of course, I mean, it has a lot of nice things. By the way, I like Britain and British people. So I don't want anything against them or English language. I'm just saying that victory is not everything. Even if America wins the next war in a bloody conflict, I think the American hegemony will be over. So war is bad for the victors too. So, by the way, war is bad for everybody. We may think that you are in a nice little country, or I may think that I'm in Canada, you know, we don't have any wars. But the point is that we will be sucked into it. There is no choice if there is a global division of conflict going on. Your children will be asked to join the army. In fact, one of my things I do in my strategies of war and peace course, first thing I ask, imagine you were born in 1900 or 1890. What will you be doing at your age of 21? They all will say, well, just like our grandparents did or great-grandparents did, we probably will be in the trenches of Europe fighting this war created by a bunch of men with absolutely no idea the decisions they were making. So we really, as a discipline, we should really talk about it loudly. We should not let this poorly trained, you know, President Bush was asked, you consult your father about before going to war in Iraq. And his response was, no, I consult a higher authority. Well, you got it, what I'm trying to say, you know. So those are the men in charge, often determining the fate of human beings. So the big questions are whether the emerging power transition is going to produce war, whether we will have globalization continue, deepened economic interdependence continue, what kind of institutions will be created, whether countries will resort to soft balancing instead of hard balancing, whether the norms that prescribe forceful territorial change will continue, whether the dominance of defense and deterrence in military technology will be maintained, or whether we can avoid this intense nationalism that I mentioned. So there are some good things in the world today in this arena, but one thing is very clear. Every conflict you notice historically, the first 20 years after a big rivalry, after a big conflict conclusion, is rather peaceful. Institutions, golden age of institutions are during that first 10 years. Then you start slowly getting into this conflict dynamics. We had the post-Cold War period, 1991, 20 years of relative peace among the great powers. Now we are slowly getting into it. Unless we think about it, what we can do, what we can change, we will end up in rivalry and conflict. Probably not the same extent of what you noticed in the Cold War period, but it may be a kind of conflict that we really don't want because it will generate a lot of turbulence and damage to whatever world order we are trying to create. And as I said, I did not talk about small states much in this talk, but this book is all about great powers. But the concern that is driven for me is that small states will be number one victims. If you know the history of World War I, World War II, you will be, and European history, to be frank, you know who are the victims. Arlene is sitting here. We have a common friend called Vendulka Kubalkova. She told me that her parents, or great-great parents, changed 8 countries in the last 200 years. She's a Czechoslovak, originally born in Czechoslovakia. But she's where her home is situated. 8 countries controlled it at some point or other. So it was quite fascinating to see what a Czech Republic, what a Poland will suffer in this kind of conflict. Let me stop there. I know you may have some questions. And wait for the book. There's a lot more in it. We hope to generate a debate on this subject. And to my disappointment, the discipline is spread out on all kinds of themes. But when it comes to this, the John Mearsheimers are in charge. So it's kind of, luckily, people like Eikenberry and others, you know, at least in North America, but people like you guys also to engage this, because we shouldn't leave this only to Northern scholars. This will affect you, what I'm talking about. And we should think about how to be workers, intermediaries, bridging states, small states. In the Cold War, it tried to create non-alignment movement. Worked up to a point, but then it started losing it. We may have to think about something like that or different to be the peacemakers of the world. Thank you for listening.
Thank you, Professor. Yeah. Bueno, después de esta excelente presentación y reflexiones. Yeah, I think so. It didn't work, actually.
I got my talking part already. So what I will just quickly go through it, and you can, it's available on the system here. Anyone can get it if you want. Or you can put it on your web page if you want.
Yeah, we can do it.
You can
yeah.
do that, and then put the border.
Pedimos disculpas por la falla en el manejo electrónico de la presentación, pero como está pidiendo el profesor, cualquiera que desee acceder la puede solicitar, pues tenemos la copia y podemos subirla a una página. Ahora tenemos unos minutos para algunas preguntas. Sí, ¿no es cierto, Carlos? Así que, si quieren, yo diría que tomemos 2 o 3 preguntas. El profesor las contesta y vamos dando vueltas así en un par de rondas si están de acuerdo. Por favor, ¿te podrías presentar y decirnos?
Yeah. Okay. Good morning. Thank you for being here. My name is Grazia Trentini. Mi nombre es Grazia Trentini. Soy italiana. I'm Italian, but I lived here for 3 years already. And I'm very interested in what you said, even if you know my field is not international relations. I very much agree with you when you say that the small countries are the victims when people don't know how to solve their conflicts. One thing you said caught my attention. You talked about legitimacy, right? So we live in a world where the UN or here in South America, we have different organizations, you know, should be, you know, guaranteeing legitimacy, and they can't. Because as you said, you know, in the case of India, they just tell them you can be in the Security Council. So you recognize you exist, but we don't give you any power. So, do you have any more practical suggestions in order to think how to deal with legitimacy around the world? Because I'm not just talking about Europe or how the UN handled this, but in South America as well. If you have some knowledge, please. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Legitimacy. First questions. One more. ¿Alguna otra pregunta que quieren hacer? Pueden hacerla en castellano y después la traducimos al profesor. No.
Legitimacy. Oh, there's a question. Oh. Why don't you get that by like?
I have a definition of legitimacy in one of my...
Thank you, Professor. My name is Joanna Maya. I'm from Colombia. I'm researching about truth commissions. We are comparing edge cases studies around the world. My question is about the role of peace communities in internal conflicts. We have a lot of experience in Colombia, and I want to know about the role of social movements and peace experience that makes peace in the territories. And in the other side, I would like about the violation of human rights in this context of these accommodation powers. Thank you.
I can talk a little bit about the second one, but probably not that much, but I'll give it a shot. The other work I'm doing is essentially, it's about legitimacy, great action. Great powers need legitimacy. Power, anybody wants to be accepted as a powerful needs legitimacy, especially in the contemporary world. Legitimacy has had a different definition during the colonial period, during the imperial period, because they didn't really give a damn. So the European sitting at the Vienna Congress of Vienna, they had no interest about giving any power to anybody other than the five great powers. And so legitimacy today is not so easy for a great power to get it. That's why the UN Security Council is not reforming easily. They will create problems. Legitimacy is defined as a tacit acceptance of social structure in which power is exercised. It implies lawfulness by virtue of being authorized or in accordance with the law. And that is why institutions are very important. Now I use other people's definition, by the way. The importance of institutions today to get legitimacy. And that's where small states work very hard to show that they matter through institutional bargaining. So your South American context, you have institutions, Mercosur or OAS, etc. In the ASEAN context, they try to make sure China comes to the meetings and negotiate with them, whatever it does. So the Chinese don't want this multilateral forum because they know that they will be sidelined, so they go for bilateral solely. Now, these institutions are important because without it, small states have little say in the way international order is conducted. We can make a lot of noise, we can make civil society, we can make protests. I come from a state called Kerala, almost like some of the Latin American countries in terms of growth, development, and revolutionary movement. First elected communist government, by the way, which is now a social democratic country. And there they protest all the time against American hegemony. But nobody gives any attention because, you know, what can you do? The problem is institutions are where you can bargain. Put them in a context where you create institutions and ideas. And therefore, civil society has very much importance than internal structures, but external structures often, what we notice is only in episodes or issue areas that they have been successful, and they give up after a while. They really need to focus on what they can achieve. The Global Minds movement was interesting, but then what happened? The Global Zero movement, you know, where is the anti-atomic group? But they can be big opinion makers, ideas generators, and there I think we can definitely use the ideas for that context. Legitimacy is important because without legitimacy in the 21st century to become a powerful state will be very hard. The Chinese are lacking that. They had quite a bit through their security council, etc. So they're trying to create their own institutions. They're trying to build these networks, banks separately, BRIC Bank, etc., Asian Development Bank, Asian Bank of Infrastructure, Silk Route, Maritime Silk Route, and providing some assistance and as well as economic. All that is giving them short-term support and legitimacy. They're not making permanent friends, unfortunately. They themselves have to ask the question, what is missing there? Because I think countries are starting to realize that maybe they have a bigger agenda, which we don't want another America or another imperial power to be replaced, but that too, something that we are not familiar with in terms of cultural understanding. So China has a long way to go. They used a lot of soft power. Now they are trying to use some hard power. And that hard power is not giving them the... They're losing all the soft power they achieved by using force. The moment you use force against small states, it creates a lot of problems. The Americans know that. But somehow the Americans have other forms of soft power that gives them the power. So legitimacy is very important. I think we need to think about more about what produces legitimacy, what sustains it, what can change it, and how smaller actors also can by creating ideas, opinions, questions, question marks created. So it's a big topic. It's a very philosophical topic, by the way. There are interesting books in IR, Ian Clark and others. English School have written a lot on this subject. But I'm a little, I'm not a great fan of their very convoluted language and making very much a very English project, which they should broaden to the rest of the world. Anyway, I have Tim sitting there, but he's luckily a Canadian and he's not going to agree with me, disagree with me. The truth commissions are fascinating topics. I know many of you have been, probably have been to South Africa. One of the most fascinating human history, when history is written maybe 2,000 years from now, is the way Nelson Mandela and others managed South Africa's transition. Now, I'm not saying it is the fantastic experience of peacefulness or anything. It's one of the most violent places and most crime-ridden if you visit. But I visited in, I think, 1991, just 2 years after the change. And I took a walk. At first, I went to Robben Island to see his cell. Then I went to the presidential palace. I stood outside for almost an hour, hoping he will come out. Obviously, he didn't. But the point is that it was a moment of thinking that this man could have created so much violence in that society. And then a woman passed by, who, looking at me, and said, "Why are you sitting here?" "I'm just taking a moment to understand, think about what a contribution to peaceful change." Doesn't mean a perfect place. And I asked her a question, "Why don't you feel the vengeance, you know, the revenge? If you are a victim of apartheid, my first feeling will be how to kill another, the one who did that to me, you know?" She said, "We don't feel that. We have reconciled. We are forgiven because you can't change." That was a real impressive thing about it. And that Truth and Reconciliation Commission worked a lot there. And I come from South Asia, as I said, the Indians and the Pakistanis haven't done that yet. They don't have a Truth and Reconciliation Commission yet on the partition. So they try to compart victims as well as their children, by the way. Try not to think about it. You ask the question, and there are still people who perpetrated violence are living. And those who try to interview them will refuse to answer, saying, "I don't want to think about it. It happened." So Truth and Reconciliation Commission, properly done, can enormously help societies. I'm not that up on Colombia yet, so I'll try to read that. But at the international level, this is one thing that Japan and China should probably do. The Germans did that better with Israel. The Japanese have great difficulty getting acceptance, getting legitimacy, by the way, great topic there, because they haven't really reconciled with the idea that they perpetrated a lot of crime. Now, the more I read about it, if you look from their point of view, the Western countries also have a lot of blame to share where they ended up. They thought they were fighting an imperial war to get some power and territory. They thought they will have no choice. The territory population was growing. They needed Asia. Otherwise, they will be consigned as India in terms of colonial power. So the European countries and the United States failed miserably by putting sanctions on them and putting them in a corner, allowing the militarists to take over. This is one thing about sanctions. By the way, perfect examples of sanctions need not produce the best results. We think that economic sanctions are the best for peaceful ideas, but not really. Japan was, they're targeted with economic, and that is the reason why Japan struck in Pearl Harbor. Said, "We have enough gas for petroleum for 1.5 years. Let's go and attack. Otherwise, we will be completely lost, this conflict, for preventing preemptive war." Anyway, so internal examples. We need to look at these instances where success took place, failure took place for internal conflicts, whether we can translate that into external conflicts. Perhaps the Chinese talk about the Nanjing massacre or all this. are because there is a lot of grievance, the fear or the feeling that the Japanese haven't reconciled. So truth and reconciliation, I don't know how you do it in that kind of intense nationalistic milieu. It should have been done a long time back. Good point.
Bien, de esta manera estamos concluyendo la transmisión de TV Paul, quien ofreció la segunda conferencia magistral en este tercer encuentro latinoamericano y caribeño de ciencias sociales. Tenemos algunos inconvenientes con el audio, pero creo que la audiencia que ha estado sintonizando el espacio ha podido escuchar una parte sustantiva de los argumentos de TV Paul. Queremos comunicarles que a partir de las 6 de la tarde con 45 minutos, hora de Ecuador, tendremos la tercera conferencia magistral a cargo de Joan Subirats. Así es que le invitamos a sintonizar Flaxo Radio a partir de esa hora, las 6 de la tarde con 45 minutos, para que usted pueda escuchar esta ponencia que desarrollará el profesor Joan Subirats. Bueno, entonces siga usted con la señal de Flaxo Radio. En este momento les dejamos con Escenario de Conciertos, la mejor música clásica que se produce y se transmite también en la señal de Flaxo Radio.